This is the Next Bite of Life podcast, the place to be to hear personal stories from expats, digital nomads, and everybody else taking their next bite of life. Thank you for joining me on this episode of Next Bite of Life podcast. My name is Kem Kem. Today, I've got a special guest by the name of Stephen Williams. Stephen is a YouTube creator and an author. I'm so thrilled to have you on the show today. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm doing well. Good to be Thanks. Here.
Thanks for you know, coming on the show. I'm so thrilled.
Of course.
I wanted to talk to you about a few things. Now,
absolutely.
Right off the bat, I got to say, you've got like almost 400,000 followers on YouTube. That's incredible. I mean,
it's
absolutely fantastic. How long did it take you to get up to that kind of number?
Up until right about just now. So probably about three and a half years, something like that. So I've probably done about 100,000 a year.
That's amazing.
Since I've been on the platform. So yeah, I've been very fortunate in that regard. So I'm very grateful that that really wasn't a mountain that I had to climb. That kind of happened very easily.
Yeah.
You know, I was praying, you know, I was praying, God, please let me get to 100,000 subscribers. And I was like, in 2019, it was like 2019 or 2018. I was like, I'm going to get 100,000 subscribers. I really want to do it by the end of the year. And then it happened in like 6 months.
It's amazing. Wow.
So, yeah.
I couldn't even really dream that high. I mean, I can't even dream that high on any platform, whether it's YouTube or Instagram or whatever. So I really admire people that can make it work. Now, before we start and dive into the travel and everything else, tell us where you're at now.
I am currently in Maryland, in Towson, Maryland, where I was born, where I was raised. I've been here now since July, so probably about 5 months I've been here since the pandemic started. My family is here. Before this, I was in New York. I spent the past 12 years in New York, New York City. That's where I went to school. That's where I got all my work experience, my internship experience. That's where all my friends are. So, that's where I was before this, minus a little year that I took off to go live in Spain.
Okay, great. We're going to get back to that later, but I wanted to move back just a little bit. You were in New York for 12 mm-hmm. years. How was it living in New York?
Yes.
How was that life?
you know, so many different adjectives that I could use to describe life in New York. But for me, New York was great. For the simple fact that New York was for me. New York was very much for me. And that is kind of a thing with me in travel. I know when a place is for me the first time that I go. The first time I went to New York City, I was 10 years old. Okay. We got off the bus in Times Square and like I walked two blocks and I just knew. Wow. It was like a flash of clairvoyance in my brain. And I just knew that I was gonna live there one day. I was absolutely certain. So yeah, New York was for me until it wasn't. Until it wasn't.
The pandemic has really wrecked havoc in a lot of lives and a lot of plans. And where were you when it first happened? And when did you say, you know what, it's enough. I need to like go back and regroup somewhere.
Well, you know, I had been wanting to leave New York for a while.
Yeah.
You know, I have got, because of my career, I have gotten to travel to Los Angeles quite frequently. And as I got older, matured, just my preferences for lifestyle just changed. They changed. And you know, every time I would go to LA, I wouldn't want to leave.
That sounds like me a few years ago. You
know? I never wanted to leave. It would be so hard to get me on the plane to go back to New York, leaving LA. And you know, so a lot of what we've seen happen because of the pandemic in terms of the economy and work and things like that, you know, homelessness and all of those things. In places like New York City and San Francisco, those things were already happening.
Yes,
definitely. And those things have been happening in New York City for quite some time.
Oh, yeah.
And you could kind of just see New York going on this like downward trend over the past few years because of the inequality gap. It just keeps getting bigger. The homelessness problem in New York keeps getting worse. The city just keeps getting dirtier and dirtier and dirtier. And I just, you know, I didn't want that for my life anymore.
Yeah. But you know, better in LA.
It's a little better in LA in the sense that LA is much more spread out.
Well, that's true.
And it's much larger.
Yeah.
Because when we talk about Los Angeles, we're talking about Los Angeles, the city.
Yes.
Which has a lot of these problems that we're talking about.
Yeah.
But when people really talk about Los Angeles, they're talking about Los Angeles, the city, and Los Angeles County, which is huge.
That's true. That's very true.
And so Los Angeles County, you have so many different, you know, you got so many different types of areas. You've got wooded areas. You've got mountain areas. You've got lake areas. You've got beachy areas. There's just so many different types of things in terms of lifestyle that you can get into.
True.
In Los Angeles. And so that is really, you know, what I'm looking for. A lot of the economic problems are still going to be there because they're all over the United States right now. Yes. But when it comes to just a peaceful, quiet, green, you know, natural lifestyle, LA is the place. One of many places, but that is the place for me.
It's funny when you said that, you know, you just knew and you didn't want to leave LA every time you went, you know, you went there. I used to live in Boston, and every time I would visit LA, it's like every weekend. I had every other weekend off, and I would go to LA and then it's like, oh my God, it's getting really hard to go back. And I always wanted to, even while I was in school, I wanted to live there. And finally, after one big, huge snowstorm, I was just like, this is it. I'm going to take my test. And if I pass, that's it. And I did. And I holed up in a motel in Hollywood for a while. And I passed the test and I gave my notice. And then my company is like, you know, we're expanding to Los Angeles. So anybody who wants to move. And I was like, yeah. So that's how I ended up like moving to LA. So it was just like, I finished work here like on a Friday and I started there like, you know, a week break and I started the following week. So it was great. And it was great for 20 years. But while I was there, I still had this urge to live in San Francisco. I'm like, that is it for me. Because it sort of reminded me of Boston, but it was, you know, you were in California, but I got there and I saw the homeless problems and I was working in the Castro district and it was just like, it was terrible, but you know.
Here's the thing. Yeah, I can't imagine. I've never been to San Francisco, but I've heard how bad that problem is there. Oh, and the thing is, I can't even imagine what that must be like because I know how bad it is in New York, and I also know how bad it is in LA, and that already is unbearable.
Because
everybody says it's worse.
Yeah, because it's smaller, and you come out of the metro stop, or you know. The bus line or the and you just see, and there's a lot of like young girls who are like pregnant out to here. And it's just like really sad because you're saying to yourself, you're somebody's kid. You really should go back home. You're 16. You know, the hippie era has ended and it's just, but you know, at one point, and I think it's probably still the same, San Francisco gives the highest amount of money to the homeless people, like, you know, so everybody does the journey. All the homeless people from everywhere go there because that's where they get the most money. So it's just really, really bad. And after my 6 months working there, I was like, never. I mean, it got rid of my taste for wanting to live there, you know.
Yeah.
Even if you live like, you know, in the fancy places, you still have to come down and see.
Right.
There.
Right.
You're confronted the whole time. Like in LA, you can sort of go like, okay, if I don't go to Venice Beach or whatever, you know, you can sort of compartmentalize it. You know, you can, if I go downtown, then I'm okay. But I used to work like the pharmacy.
Oh, no, not downtown is, it's bad now. They're everywhere downtown. Like homelessness is everywhere downtown now in LA.
I used to work with this pharmacy and we worked a lot with the hospices, like, you know, end of life care and all that. So I had to go like once a week to go to the, I actually bought a really banged up used car to like take with me, you know, to drive there when it was that day. Mm-hmm. And I only drove it that day, but it was worth it because I couldn't take my regular car. It was just that bad, right, you know, of a problem. So I can just imagine, and this was like, I left LA like, you know, 10 years ago. I can just imagine what it's like today. So where would you be like in LA? Which part of LA would you go to, you think?
You know, I have a preference for water, and I have a preference for wooded areas. So I'm thinking, you know, somewhere by a beach or somewhere up in the mountains, you know, surrounded by trees, or maybe somewhere like a little up, you know, outside on the outskirts by like one of the lakes. You know, I really like very, very natural environments. And I probably have New York City to thank for that, that yeah, has become my preference, because for 12 years, I was like, I was surrounded by concrete and skyscrapers.
Yeah, it's funny how your needs change as you grow older, isn't it? What you thought exactly was the most important thing is no longer it.
Correct. That is exactly what happened.
So now talk to me about like the cost of living in New York for a single person, for instance, like tell, you know, just try and,
horrible.
Yeah, try and tell us like what it was like, you know, how much you spend on rent and food. And
Well, here's the thing. You get used to it. You really do get used to it. Yeah. But it is an outrageously expensive city. If anyone has ever been to, you know, places like London or San Francisco, is very, very similar in terms of cost of living. It's very abnormal and outrageous how much things cost. You know, like a fast food meal might cost you, probably will cost you like anywhere from $12 to $15 to, you know, to go to McDonald's. I don't eat McDonald's, but I'm, you know, if you go to McDonald's, you're going to spend about $12 on your meal. And rent, I mean, if you're trying to get a one bedroom, and this is pre-pandemic, things have changed because of the pandemic, but before the pandemic, you're talking rent. I'll put it this way. When friends would visit my apartment, my last apartment, they were shocked that I was not paying $2,000 or more. Because that would have been the norm for an apartment like the one that I had.
Oh, wow.
But I found the most outrageous deal. This beautiful apartment, it was renovated. It was on the same block as an express train.
Okay. An express subway train. Yeah, which is golden, right?
Like, and I think I got in at like $1,600.
Wow.
And it was a one bedroom. A huge one bedroom, like my bedroom was huge, my living room was huge, like all things that just don't happen in New York City.
New York, yeah.
And people were like, how did you find this?
Were you looking for cracks of mold and stuff like that, thinking that they didn't tell me something? So
here's the thing. I had been going and looking at apartments, and you know, they were showing me just crap after crap after crap after crap for so much money. And you know, I went back to my job. I went back to the office and I was really frustrated. And I said, no, absolutely not. Absolutely not. My apartment is out there and I know it is. I know it is. I know it is. So I just sat there for an hour and just booked. I like booked like just appointment after appointment after appointment after appointment. Left the office because I was booking them for that day. It was like the morning. And I was like, I'm booking these appointments for today because I'm going to find my apartment.
Today.
Left the office and like from like probably about 2 p.m. in the afternoon to about 6 o'clock at night, I was just touring apartments. And then the apartment I moved in was the second one that I saw that day. And yeah, it was a very nice building. Like the building, here's the thing. It was exactly what I wanted. I had very specific sort of parameters for what I wanted. I wanted it to be, you know, west of Broadway. I wanted it to be ideally near a park or something like that. It was west of Broadway, surrounded by three different parks, coming in at less than $1,700, one bedroom. The building didn't have a elevator, but I was on the first floor.
Yeah, so you're like,
eh, however, okay. The first floor, people were like, oh, well, you know, people are always going to be walking by your window. Not exactly, because the first floor was about 6 feet above the ground.
Oh God, yeah, so it has to be a very tall person.
So it was just the most perfect place. I actually talk about it in my book.
You actually talk about it in my book.
Well, yeah, because, and also the great thing about it for me was I moved to a predominantly Spanish speaking neighborhood.
Okay.
I moved to a predominantly Spanish speaking neighborhood. In a great, great building in a renovated apartment that was very, very economical for me and spacious. And I got very, very lucky in that regard. But back to your initial question, you know, the average one bedroom in New York would run you at least $2,000. You know, the average studio, anywhere from $1,500 to $2,000 a month.
And then on top of that, you add your food, right? Yep. Which was food. Guesstimate?
Probably about anywhere from $75 to $100 every time I would go to the grocery store. In New York, you kind of have to go to the grocery store often in New York, unless you have a car, which nobody does. You know, it's not like you go in the grocery store, you load everything into your cart,
exactly.
And then you load everything into your car. It's like, no, I have to take what I can carry home.
Exactly.
So it's like, okay, I'm going to get this today. And then I know I'm going to come back in 3 days and get the rest of the stuff that I didn't get so I can carry it. But
were the utilities expensive too?
Utilities were actually not that bad.
Really? Okay.
Utilities were not that bad. It would get a little bit if it got like really cold in the winter, mm-hmm. or if it got really hot in the summer and you really had to blast the heat or you really had to blast the AC, mm-hmm. Those couple of months, the utilities would go a bit higher, but generally, in the U.S., utilities aren't that bad they're more expensive than they are in Spain, but they're still not really that bad.
Yeah.
So utilities are okay.
If you were to guesstimate how much you were paying per month, would you put it roughly $3,004, something like that?
Oh, yeah. My total expenses were about $3,000 a month.
So mm-hmm. that's very expensive, I mean, compared to a lot of places. Now, did you have a huge culture shock when you went from Maryland, right, to New York, like paying Maryland prices, or is it just almost as expensive? Did you have a...
You know, I did not go through culture shock because, you know, I was very fortunate. You know, I've been able to travel quite frequently throughout my life ever since I was a child. So I was very familiar with New York City.
Okay.
I moved there when I was 18, but like I said, the first time I went, I was 10. And from 10 up until 18, when I finally moved there, me and my family would visit New York 2-3 times a year.
Okay.
So I was very familiar. I knew what to expect. I knew what I was getting into. The university I went to, I actually did a summer program for 2 weeks there in New York City while I was in high school.
Okay.
So I was very familiar with New York City.
Gotcha.
So yeah, there wasn't really a whole lot of culture shock. And also, what I found was, this might sound crazy, but for me, I had more culture shock being born in Maryland. Like, that was my culture shock.
You're like, I belong in New York. What did I do?
Well, it was like, it was like, what are all you people doing here? And then I went to New York for the first time at 10 years old. And I was like, yes, this is what life is supposed to be like. This
I've never been to Maryland, so I can't imagine what it's like.
It's just a normal place. It's a normal place.
But you were like, I was born for excitement. I was born for New York City, you know? It's like somebody made a mistake. The start was like a little bit off, you know?
Exactly.
So you rectified it when you were 18 and you went there, you made it, you know?
Yes, it was like a relief.
Yeah. So when you got to New York, you're like, this is it. And every year it kept getting better and better until the pandemic made you, you know, reassess things. or just before that you were
actually realized? Honestly, the first time I went to LA was when things began to change. I went to LA for the first time in 2010.
Okay.
And at that point, I had been in New York for a few years. I was still in college.
Okay.
And I, when I saw what LA was like, I was like, I could get into this. I could really get into this. You know, LA helped me declare my major, my studies at Fordham, because I hadn't really declared. I knew I was going to study media, but I didn't know what sect of media I was going to study. And then, you know, going to LA, I did lots of movie studio tours. And then I realized, okay, I really think I want to study film and television. So it helped with that. It helped me see what different lifestyles were like. You know, I had a lot of friends in college who were from LA.
Yeah.
And I had never experienced weather like that.
Yeah.
And I think people don't really realize how much weather affects your body and affects your mood.
Your mood
it has so much to do with it. Mm-hmm. And that temperate climate just agreed with me so, so well. And ever since then, you know, I kind of had my eyes on it. And then I had sort of something to compare New York to because exactly. I was always comparing New York to Maryland.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I had, you know, something else to compare New York to. So it was like, kind of like, oh, okay, there's more out there. There's more for me to experience. There's more for me to get to do in terms of lifestyle and where I live.
Now, how did, I know you lived in Madrid for a year. How did that come about? Yes. Was it while you were living in New York? Tell us about that experience.
Oh my God. So crazy, craziest thing. I studied abroad. Okay. In college for a summer with Boston University. I studied abroad with Boston University. Yep.
My sisters went to school there.
Yeah. So I didn't go to BU because I went to school in New York. I went to Fordham University in New York. Fordham has a really good partnership with Boston University for study abroad. So all of the credits directly transfer over. No problem. Cool. So I studied abroad with BU for a summer. And, you know, so I spent like 2 months in Madrid for a summer and I really liked it. You know, I really, really enjoyed it. And at the end, you know, I was like, I kind of feel like that wasn't enough. And I, you know, I had an understanding that Madrid was not a place that I would want to live long term.
Yeah.
But I did also have an understanding that I did want to stay there for longer than 2 months.
Yeah.
So, and you know, it was funny because I was meeting a lot of people that summer that I was there. I made a lot of friends. And, you know, they would always ask me, well, when do you think you'll come back? Well, when do you think you'll come back? And I was like, I don't know. I'm in college and I
class and then come like, back with it.
Right. It's like, I'm in college and I have no money. So I don't know. But it's funny. Every time I got asked that question a lot. And every time I would answer, I don't know, you know, there was a voice in my head that would say they would repeat the exact same thing every time I would answer the question. And it would say, you're going to be back here sooner than you think you will.
Yeah.
Like, and I was just like, every time I was like, oh, that's weird. I would hear it as clear as day, like in my spirit, I could just hear that. And so I came back to New York. This was to complete my last year at university. And like the idea of going back to Madrid would just not get out of my head. It would not leave me. And I think it was New Year's Eve, 2011, going into 2012. I was at a party and somehow the topic came up of me potentially moving to Spain. Like, oh, why don't you go back? Why don't you go back? And a couple drinks into that conversation on New Year's Eve, I was just like, all right, I think I've made the decision. I'm going to do it.
Wow.
And the crazy thing about that was, okay, so the first time I went and I studied abroad, I get there and I'm there for about a week. And then I'm on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting in my room and I'm on Facebook. And I see that one of my friends from college is in Madrid. And I'm like, wait, what? What is he doing here? So I message him and he's like, oh yeah, I'm here for the summer. I'm doing this like medicine program. He's a doctor now. So he was doing a medicine sort of program in Spain for the summer. And so I got to hang out with one of my good friends that whole summer. And the crazy thing was, so I decided to move back. I got all of the stuff in order. and was ready to go. And one day I was talking to this same friend and he says to me, so I'm going back to Spain. I'm going back to Madrid in the fall of 2012. And I was like, are you serious? And he's like, yeah, why? And I'm like, because I'm going back to Madrid.
Wow.
In the fall of 2012.
That is so cool.
And, but no, not even just that, like other friends of mine were also doing the exact same thing. It was the craziest thing ever. It was like okay, so everybody I know wants to move to Madrid now. Great. Let's all go. And so yeah, I got to go and it was great because I had lots of friends, like friends that I had already had in Spain, friends from New York who had decided to move to Spain. So in that regard, like that whole part of it was great and you know, really helped me take that leap.
That's great. Now, how did you go about getting the visa and everything? Was it hard at that time too? Like, how was the process for you?
It's actually pretty easy. So I found a program online. Right after that New Year's Eve party, I just got online, you know, because I had met lots of, when I studied abroad, I'd met lots of English teachers in Madrid. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone sort of said the same thing. It's just like a really easy way to legally live in Spain and make money.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, Spain loves to bring in people who can help their people with English.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, I wasn't really interested in, you know, teaching languages or anything like that, but I understood that it was something that I could do. I knew it would be sort of a low lift. And so I found this government program with the Spanish government. They had this program where they bring Canadians, Americans, mm-hmm. Brits, Australians, and the like mm-hmm. to Spain. And they place them all over the country in the public school system mm-hmm. As English teaching assistants. Mm-hmm. So I applied for that program, had no idea whether or not I was going to be accepted because like this was the time that Spain was going through that terrible, terrible economic crisis.
Uh-huh. Of course,
and
yes.
So they were limiting drastically the amount of students that they were bringing mm-hmm. to teach English. Mm-hmm. And it was basically, if you meet the requirements, like college graduate, you mm-hmm. know, the requirements were not very, you know, intense. Mm-hmm. And if you meet the requirements, you'll essentially get accepted. So it's first come, first serve.
Yeah.
And I had a very high application number. Yeah. So I was like, I don't know if I'm going to get it.
I'll see you guys there someday.
So what I did was I knew without a shadow of a doubt that I was supposed to be there. And so I just said, you know what? I'm going to go regardless and I'm going to figure it out. Crazy, right?
Yes.
Just move across the world.
I tell people not to do on the e-course, you know.
Move across the world and just figure it out. And the only reason I was able to do that, I knew that I was supposed to be there. Can't explain it, but I just knew. And I found a school that would give me an English teaching certification in Madrid.
Okay.
And then they would help with, you know, job placement, you know, working in banks or schools, whatever mm-hmm. it was. They, you know, had a connection with a language academy in the city in Madrid that mm-hmm. was able to process the student visa for us. Mm-hmm. So all of that just kind of worked out in that regard. And I got there. Took my English certification course for a month. It was a group of maybe like seven Americans. And we all became really good friends. And then I started working in a bank, teaching in the morning, teaching in the afternoon. Ended up getting let go from that job, which was a whole nother story. But before I got let go from that teaching job in Madrid in the bank, I got an email. This was about October. Mm-hmm. I think I got let go from the job in November, and like mid-October, I got an email from the Spanish government, mm-hmm. and in the email was like, "Hey, remember that program that you applied for back in January uh-huh. to be an English teaching assistant in the public school system? Guess what? Your application has officially been accepted,
That's amazing.
And your school is ready for you."
Wow.
Now, I knew applying that that was a chance that that could happen because, you know, I talked to lots of people who had done the program before.
Yeah.
And the idea was if you get a late acceptance, they expect you to come for the second semester of the school year.
Okay.
So this was October, so that made perfect sense. But here's the crazy part. It was, I swear to you, it was a divine act of God because not, I was accepted late, but I still got my first choice city to teach in, which was Madrid.
Wow.
Which was the place that I had lived. Because my thing was, oh, well, you know, if I get accepted, I'm probably not going to get Madrid.
Yeah, you'll be like in
In Valencia. It could be in Valencia. It could be in Granada.
Not even that. You'll be in like some little village outside of.
Or that, like, I could be in Cuenca somewhere.
I know, exactly. You know?
And I was like, oh my God, Madrid. And, you know, but this time I was working at the bank. I was also working as a tour guide, doing Segway tours of Madrid for tourists.
You're like, I'm just, I've got a lot
So I was like, I don't really need that right now, but something in my spirit said, don't tell them no.
Exactly.
Something in my spirit just said, just let the email sit there.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up getting let go from the bank job. And I knew that my tour guide job was not going to be enough.
It's not.
And so I went, told the guy who I was doing tours for that I was going to leave. And literally, I left his office, walked 10 minutes up the street on Gran Vía. If you know Madrid, there's Gran Vía.
Yeah, I do.
That, so on Gran Vía is where the Ministry of Education is. So I just walked 10 minutes up the road.
Like, I'm there.
told security, like, hey, I need to speak to this person. They let me right up. And I went upstairs. And I was like, hey, so I'm here.
I'm going to take it.
And I'm formally accepting this position. When can I start?
And he's like, wow, this is
They were looking at me like I had five heads.
Yeah.
Because like I said, they don't expect people who get late acceptances
exactly
to show up.
Yeah, uh-huh. Suddenly not to show up in the office.
Yeah. Right. They don't expect you there until January. And they also are expecting for, you know, you to work with them to get, you know, all of your visas and all of that stuff together. But I'd already had it all worked out.
Yeah.
And they were like, wait, so you're here? And I'm like, yeah, I'm here. And they're like, so you have a student, like you have a visa? And I was like,
yeah.
And they were like, how did you get a visa? And I was like, don't worry about that.
No, exactly. Just accept the fact that I'm here.
Don't worry about that. But you see this passport with the visa right in it? I have
it.
Exactly. I got it. And they, you know, she got on the computer. Yeah. That's him. That's his school. They're ready for you. You can show up tomorrow.
Wow.
And just.
So it was meant to be.
Just like that.
Wow.
And then I had a steady job for the entire time that I initially planned to be there.
That's great. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And of course, the cost of living compared to New York was.
It was such a relief. It was such a relief.
Tell us how much it was there. You know, so
here's the thing. They were
jealous.
They were paying us 1,000 euros a month,
mm-hmm.
and that was enough to live, to eat, to go out, to travel. it was insane.
It's amazing because one of the things that I try to impress on people like on the e-course is like, if you're willing to make that change, you know, you're so used to the American prices and how much it is. You can't believe how much cheaper it is in Spain, for instance, in France. I mean, just about every place else. People rush to Asia because it's cheaper and everything. But when you think about it, Europe is just as reasonable.
It really is. It really is.
And I'm trying to impress that upon people that even though you don't think you can, you really can. So here you are, testament, somebody who lived there who's saying that on 1,000 euros, he was able to live in Madrid, okay? In Madrid.
And here's the kicker that'll really drive it home. The 1,000 euro payment was only if you were placed in Madrid. If you were anywhere else, they were giving you like like probably about 600 or 700 euro.
Imagine because that.
Outside of Madrid,
yeah,
the cost of living is even
cheaper.
like in Granada. Like I could not get over how cheap everything was in Granada. Like, and here's what I would tell people. In Granada, we would, on a night out in Granada, we would stop ordering drinks and food when we were out of coins. Because that is how cheap, that's how cheap everything is.
And of course, so the green tapa, right? With the drink.
Right. And it's like, I don't really want to break my 20 euro bill. No.
Once this €5 is gone, this is it.
Right. So like once these coins are gone, we're done. But like your coins will get you through the whole night.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, people need to know, like stop watching just everything they pour down your throat in the US. Life outside the US is so much more reasonable. You know, people go to Mexico because of that. They go to all this place, you know, Ecuador because of that. But €1,000, and even today, I think they've upped it since like 2012. And I think in Madrid, they pay them like 1200 now or something. But I mean, that's still enough to have a good life. And it's not saying that you have to do it forever, especially if you have a degree, right? It's something right. It's a way for you to come in and get to know the country. Maybe you know, you live there a while, you think, I want to stay longer, and then you can look for other ways to stay. So here you are telling people it's doable. I mean,
so doable. I actually really want to come back. not for like a year. I want to, you know, I really want to, once this pandemic,
I know,
has calmed.
I know. It's down. Like everything is post or pre post, you know, it's like you can't plan, you know, solidly.
Yeah. It's I really want to come for like 3 months, and really get to see the places that I didn't really get to see. Yeah. Like I've been to Granada several times, but like I've never spent a significant amount of time there. Like I want to spend like a month in Granada. Mm-hmm. I want to do a month in Barcelona. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to travel to País Vasco, Galicia, all these places that I never really got to see while I was there because I spent so much time in Madrid. And then, you know, really just go somewhere that where I know I won't have to break the bank.
Exactly. You know, and it's like a whole bunch of places in Spain. There's so many places that you can go to where you're not breaking the bank. Now, when you come back, you know, you say to yourself, after the pandemic, I'll come back. And you're going for 3 months on an American passport. You can go for 3 months without needing any sort of visa. And I tell people that's also a great way to come and see if you will like the country. It's a great way because, you know, with that blue passport, there's so many countries you can go to without needing something except for after 90 days. So it's great if you have that urge and you can go and check out other countries and see if you like it or not, because you never know. If you don't like it, hey, you can always go back home, right?
Now, when
you were there and you went back, you know, then you had to adjust back to the New York prices. So it was like, so you had culture shock and then you had reverse culture shock.
I have a great story about that. So the culture shock did not happen after the year in Madrid.
Okay.
The culture shock happened the first time after the summer in Madrid.
Ah, okay.
people were like, how did you have culture shock coming back home? You were only there for a summer. And I would tell people, you got to understand, like I'm truly bilingual, which meant I was really able to immerse myself and just be lost in the culture. So it was like the American sensibilities were the furthest thing from my mind. Like me, and it was funny, I got there, studied abroad. The school picked us up and I was on the bus and I was sitting next to this guy who was in the program with me and we started talking and he was like, oh, where do you go to school? I was like, I go to Fordham in New York City. He's like, oh, where are you from? I'm like, I'm from Baltimore. He's like, oh, you're from Baltimore? Crazy. I'm from New York City, but I go to school in Baltimore. And I was like, are you serious? And he's like, yeah, I go to Hopkins. He was a Johns Hopkins student. And so he and I like became really good friends, and we didn't really want to have an American experience abroad.
Yeah, you wanted
so we
to kind immerse of yourself. Yeah.
We kind of disassociated ourselves from the other students in the program. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we went and made Spanish friends and European friends.
I'm gonna stop you for one second just to mention that for those who don't know, Steven is completely fluid in Spanish.
Yes.
I mean, completely. So for him, the experience must have been even richer than somebody who was just an American going. Sorry, I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, exactly. So I was really able to get in it and just get lost in it. So I came back. I flew back to New York. And went right to the college dorm. I didn't have like a room in the dorm, but like I had some friends who were there for the summer. So I was in the dorms, and we went out the very same night that I got back. And I remember it being like 11 o'clock at night, and we were on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and I'm just looking around and everyone is so drunk. But like pissy, sloppy, visibly like throwing up in the streets, stumbling down the sidewalk.
So the full New York experience.
right. Something that is completely normal in New York City. But because I had been in Spain, where when it comes to alcohol and drinking, people are a lot more in control of themselves.
Yes.
I was looking around like, what? Like, is it a full moon? Like, what is going on? And then a friend pulled me aside. She was an American. Mm-hmm. However, she lived most of her life on a military base in Italy.
Okay.
And so she pulled me aside, and she had that sort of perspective to be able to tell me, I know what's happening.
Yeah.
You're having culture shock from having lived in Europe for the first time.
Yeah.
And and because you spoke Spanish and you could really immerse yourself,
exactly.
You kind of forgot how things work over here.
Like, what are these people?
And I was like, what is going on? I remember I went to the bank machine to get money out, and this green paper came out of the bank machine, I sat there for 5 minutes at the bank machine, like, what is this?
I know, it's like, where's my euro
money? And what this is not money. And then I went, who do I complain to?
You had to switch back, you know? And imagine, that was just 3 months. So I can just imagine, you know, the whole year that you were there.
Well, the year was a lot easier.
Yeah.
The year was a lot easier because I knew what to expect. And also I came back for the Christmas holidays.
Okay.
And so I came back for the Christmas holidays. I flew into New York, spent like a week in New York City, then came to Maryland, spent like a week in Maryland with my family, then drove back to New York City because I was going to fly back out of New York City. So I really got, you know, to sort of dip my toes back in the U.S., go back to Spain. The culture shock, I kind of got a hold of it that second time around.
Now I gotta ask you, when you were in Madrid as a black guy, did you have a lot of problems with racism? Like, did you feel like
not problems? I was not discriminated against, and there were no problems, but there were definitely racially charged experiences. I wouldn't really call them problems.
But not enough to say I would never come back here, or not at all.
And I took it, and I've talked about this on YouTube.
I remember seeing that video, and I'm gonna link to it in the comments.
But you know, there were things like, you know, like once a guy just walked up to me in the street and asked me if I was from Africa. I'm just like, what? Hi, how are you? Nice to meet you.
I know, really.
Well,
I have to say, one of the kids in my school when I first moved to America, the first question, I went to prep school in Boston, and she was like, do you like swing on trees and don't have any clothes on? You know, and I was just like,
yes, that's exactly what we
did. She saw Tarzan, and so, you know, that was the thing. So, yeah, what did you tell, how did you answer him?
I just looked at him kind of crazy and said no, and he walked away.
Okay.
Spain is the only time I've ever been stopped by the police.
Ah.
Yeah, it's never happened to me in the U.S. It's happened in Spain twice.
And what happened?
Nothing traumatic. The first time it happened it was probably the perfect day for it to happen because I had to go into the school and I really wasn't feeling well that morning. Mm-hmm. And I was in the metro station. They stopped me, they showed their badge, asked me for my ID, you know, they see that it's an American and they're like, oh, okay, go. Mm-hmm. And then the second time I was just walking around my neighborhood, pretty late at night. I lived in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. And the cops were just patrolling. Mm-hmm. And they saw me walking. And they just stopped, rolled their window down and asked me if I was okay.
See, you're like, yeah, I'm fine, right?
Like, yeah, I'm fine. I'm good. Thank you so much. And that was it. Lots of people, who are attracted to me wanting to, have that sort of interaction with me because they don't get to necessarily do that often. It's not like America where there are Black people.
Yes.
I mean, there are Black people everywhere in Spain, but not like how it is in...
Yeah. Especially
not like
even in 2012, you know? It's only a few years, but it's changed a lot since then, yeah.
You know, it's not like, it wasn't like the US, it wasn't like the UK. So it was a little bit rarer for them. So lots of stuff like that.
But nothing like super, oh my God, you know, because that's one question people ask and they say, you know, I don't want to go there because I read somewhere, somebody told me that they were profiled or whatever. And so I'm not going to go there. And I'm like, well, you know, the same thing happens in the US. It happens everywhere else. You can't let that stop you. And compared to the US, I think it's a lot less. Mm-hmm. But, you know,
lots of... So yeah, just like lots of racially like, oh, you're saying this because it's a Black person. And it wouldn't necessarily be anything bad. Like, oh, I'm talking. And then they're like, oh, are you from Cuba? Like, no, I'm not from Cuba.
You think it's because they couldn't place you? Because here you are speaking Spanish perfectly. And, you know, it's just for them. They can't fathom like... an American speaking Spanish, you know, it's like, it's so rare that they must peg you in some little thing. So it's
like, and then also you add on the fact that, you know, my Spanish was learned in the United States, predominantly around Caribbeans. Okay. So my natural Spanish accent has a lot of Caribbean influence as well. And it's funny, when I'm in Spain, everyone is like, oh my God, you sound so Latino and Caribbean. And then like I would come to the US and everyone is like, you sound so Spanish.
It's like you can't win, right?
Can't win.
But you're like, I don't care which one, as long as I can speak it. Now your video, your YouTube channel is called American Boy.
Yes.
Like it's great. Now, how did you decide, or why did you decide to do it strictly in Spanish?
Because, so I am a creative by nature. You know, I'm a musician. I was an actor in high school. I studied film and television in college. Like, I'm just a creative by nature. And around, once I got back to New York and started my career, I was working at MTV, the music television network. And, you know, working in the creative field, but not necessarily on the creative side, it was really important to me to start building out my own personal creative footprint. Gotcha. And the thing that I kept hearing from other creators that I admired was find the thing that's gonna be super, super specific to you. Mm-hmm. Like, try to find the thing that really only you can do.
Yeah.
And like, I was thinking about that for a while. And I swear, like, again, one night I was just in my bed about to go to sleep. And it just, the idea just popped into my head like that. Just it was there. Now, when that happened, I couldn't really see what it was going to be. Like, I couldn't see, like, the ideas weren't coming to me, like this video, that video, this video, like that wasn't there. But I could feel so strongly, like very in the same sense that like I knew I was supposed to go to Spain. Mm-hmm. I could feel so certainly that something was there, and that I was gonna figure it out.
Yeah.
Fast forward to a couple of months, it's December, and I visit Puerto Rico for the first time.
Ah, nice.
I visit Puerto Rico for the first time, and I went like 2 days after Christmas. And you know, I was with some really close friends of mine that are from Puerto Rico with their families. We did New Year's in Puerto Rico. It was, that is one of my favorite trips I've ever taken.
Nice.
And during that trip, that trip was so cool because I got to have a vacation from my vacation because I flew to San Juan to be with my friends and have my vacation. Their family does a New Year's vacation to another town in Puerto Rico. So after I'm there for like 4 days, we pack up all the food, all the sangria, and we drive to the other side of the island to go to the beach house. So it's like I'm on vacation, but then I go on vacation while I'm on vacation. It was amazing.
Wonderful.
And so one night we're all sitting around the beach house, drinking sangria, and someone asks me, a Puerto Rican, one of my friends, she asks me, you know, she asked me about like different Spanish accents and why they're different. And, you know, she wanted to understand if I had any awareness of why Puerto Ricans spoke the way they do versus like a Mexican or a Spanish person. And the reason for asking this was she said, you know, I'm born and raised here, so I've never really thought about it. This is just how we speak. I've never really thought why it's different. And without preparation, without even having to think about it, I just started talking and telling her everything I knew about different Spanish accents and how they came to be and how they developed over time. And I was talking for about 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And as I'm talking about this language and dialects and the development of the language in my head, it was like, this is your YouTube channel. This is it.
Gotcha.
It was like, it's that thing that you just know down to your bones that someone asks you a question, you can just sit there and talk about it without any preparation. And that was it. And there it was born. And then, a different friend on New Year's Eve, we were sitting around eating. And he said to me, it was already kind of in my head, and he said to me, and I hadn't told anybody.
Yeah.
And he said to me, you know, you should really think about like doing some sort of creation in Spanish. He said that to me, not knowing that it was already like,
exactly.
It's like, not knowing it was already in my head. And I was like, you know, I think you might be right.
Yeah. That's great, because I think that's one language. Even though YouTube is popular everywhere, obviously there's more English speakers. Now, to have somebody who's doing it in Spanish and being able to switch back, I've watched some of the interviews you've done with others who've also learned another language, and it's just fantastic. And since I discovered your channel, I've been listening to you speak, and I'm like, I can understand what he's saying. So it really helps. And I think it helps both in English and in Spanish. So, you know, and it's rare to find those. So I'm always on the look and I'm like, oh, wow. So I'm really going through your back catalog, trying to like, you know, get better in Spanish. And it's been great. So, you know, you hit upon a really great idea.
And that's one of the things I really want folks to understand about language. It's not 100% about the words being said. Like the communication is so much more than just the words being said. And so I tell people, if you're trying to learn a language, you'll have a better time understanding someone who also speaks your native language when they speak that foreign language. And I've seen this consistently. When I was teaching English in Madrid, you know, I would show, I kind of understood this. So I would show, like, I would like show them interviews, right? Of like, you know, maybe it's like a cast of a TV show. Let's say Modern Family, for example, right? Yeah. Let's watch this interview from the cast of Modern Family, right? Well, there's a Colombian woman in that cast, mm-hmm. right? Who's bilingual. And they would always be like, oh, wow, when she speaks English, I understand every word she says. And I said, yeah, because she also speaks your native language.
Yeah.
My friend Dylan, I'm learning French, but for some reason, when he speaks French, I can understand everything he says. My French is very rudimentary, but because he's my best friend and I know him so well, he speaks a foreign language that I don't really know, I can still understand what he's saying.
True. No, it's great. So once again, it's called American Boy. You want to check it out. And I also want to hear about the book. You know, tell us about your book, what it's about.
So when I started YouTube and started making videos about language, you know, I really understand that, like, you're really not going to get everything that I have to offer in terms of how I was able to do this in a 10-minute YouTube video.
Yes.
It just, I always understood that I wanted to put something out that was a bit more substantial for the people who really wanted to dive in.
Yeah.
And so I had this book idea for a long time. And for a long time, it was just like, oh, I'm going to write a book about language learning and, like, sort of my experience. But it took a really long time for me to figure out what story I was going to tell and sort of through what sort of lens I was going to tell the story. And so what the book is essentially is a different way of looking at language learning. So often we're inundated with, like, techniques, right? Techniques. Do this, do that. Try Duolingo, try Rosetta Stone. This trick, that trick. Go to this language school, they're the best. No, go to that language school, they're the best. Take this test, take that test. Yada, yada, yada. What I have learned, having become bilingual, is that language learning is not so much a question of being able to execute all of these actions and techniques and methods. And it has much more to do with your transformation as a human being. It has everything to do with how your identity shifts and grows through the language. That is really what it's about. And what I've realized is, if you're trying to learn a language and you're trying to become fluent and you're trying to maintain that ability for your entire life, you really have to become aware of this identity shift that is happening while you're going through the process. And when you become aware of that shift, you then begin to design the sort of the process and the results that you're looking to get. You can literally, you know, you don't have to rely on Duolingo. You don't have to rely on your teachers or your professors or anything like that, which so many students do. They think, oh, I've taken this class and the class is going to make me bilingual. No, you are going to make you bilingual because you are the one that has to go through this shift in identity. It is literally an identity transformation, and you have the ability to design what that transformation looks like if you're aware that that's what it is. So essentially, it puts the power into the learner themselves to realize, if you take inventory of the thoughts that are in your head, the things that you believe, your intentions for even learning the language in the first place, like why you're actually doing this, and, you know, how it connects to what you really value in life, that is how you're then able to create a life that is rooted in that language and an identity that is rooted in that language, because you're going to be conscious of all of these things. Yeah. And it wasn't until, you know, years later that I even realized this. But once I realized that that's what it was, because for me, I never relied on just my school to teach me Spanish. Why? Because I was going out in public, you know, trying to practice with native speakers in public, because they're everywhere in the United States. The United States is a Spanish-speaking country.
Yes, yes. Yes.
Which is how I was able to learn it here. And I realized when I was young, I was having trouble really understanding people outside of the classroom. And that's when I realized, oh, the classroom is not giving me the real thing.
Yeah.
The classroom is not giving me the real thing. So I went out into the world. And then I started to make close relationships, you know, then I got a Spanish speaking job in high school. And so this life started to form around me learning this language. And then that new life began to shape my identity. And so then it no longer became a question of, oh, well, you know, my teacher's really not that good, or the class I'm taking is really not that good. That didn't even, granted, that wasn't the case. I did, I had a really good Spanish education in terms of learning, but a lot of people don't have good, you know, learning experiences in a classroom. But once I realized, oh, you know, more is going to come from what I do outside of this classroom than it's going to come from inside of the classroom. That's kind of when the wheel started turning. And so that's essentially what the book is about. The book is all about showing you how to take inventory of your actual internal power to go through this identity shift and learn this language, and how you do that mentally, how you should think about it, how you should approach it, and how you should really design a life and design an identity around this. And the thing that I really want to drive home is the universal intention and purpose behind language learning, right? Because what's the number one reason everyone in the world wants to learn a new language? Hopefully, what would you say?
Hopefully to travel and communicate with somebody.
Travel is one of them. Travel is one of them.
With somebody, you know, with other people so they can understand you.
Travel is one of them, but the number one thing I hear is I want to make more money.
Really? That's why they want to learn another language?
That's the number one thing I hear. And that probably has to do with the fact that that's a U.S. thing.
Okay.
Because and it goes for both languages, English and Spanish.
Yeah.
Spanish speakers in the U.S. want to learn English to make more money. English speakers in the U.S. want to learn Spanish to make more money. That is sort of the thing I hear. And so what I'm really driving home with this book is, regardless of what it is that you're trying, whatever external benefit that you're trying to gain, the universal intention behind languages is human connection. Uh-huh. So if your goal really isn't tied to something bigger than you, to connecting with other humans and really figuring out what you can do through this language to make someone else's life better, you really should figure that out before you really commit yourself to trying to do this. Because at the end of the day, when you learn a language, right, the amount of people around the world that you're able to communicate and interact with, it increases tenfold. And for me, what is the point of having that ability if you're not going to do it to make someone's life better? And you're just going to do it for whatever it is that you can gain. But learning that language is really not about you. It's about you being able to communicate with other people. Yep. And if you're going to be able to communicate with other people, you have to be offering them something. You have to make their life better. They should be better off after having interacted with you, and you should be better off after having interacted with them. And well, if you're only doing this, if you're only doing this because, oh, you want to get that new job that's going to, you know, get you more money, or, you know, you just want to have, you know, a nice apartment in Valencia or Madrid, you know, if that's your motivation, that's fine. Yeah, and, you know, it'll help you to an extent. But when things start getting difficult, when things get hard, it's going to be much harder to persevere through those difficulties that you're going to go through the process if your motivation is some external benefit like money or getting to travel or having a Spanish-speaking girlfriend or boyfriend or something like that. Like, those are fine motivations. Those are fine motivations to get you started, you know? But what happens when you get that job and then a year later, you're like, okay, I want to do something else.
Yeah.
Like, are you still going to stay committed?
You know, that happens a lot. People change their minds, you know, with so many things. I wanted to make sure that I wanted to learn Spanish, but now I know what you're talking about that change, because I see it happening in me, and I'm just like, okay. And every day my thoughts are like switching just a little bit. And what's this book called? I've read about it, but it's like, what's so the
English language title is Being Bilingual. Being Bilingual. The Mindful Map Towards Language Learning for Language Learners and Lovers.
Where can they get that?
It will be available on Amazon in 2021.
Great. So we'll put the link down here. Once it's available, we'll edit it and show it. And, you know, I am so glad that you came on the show. And I had one last question for you. You've traveled to quite a few places. Would you say would be your favorite, apart from Los Angeles, where you want to live? Mm. Like, where would you say was the best country that you visited and you just like, oh my God, I loved it so much?
There are two places that have a very special place in my heart. One would be Granada, España.
See? Wow.
Granada is a magical place.
It's funny, I still haven't been there. I've heard so many good things. And we used to live in Malaga, right? It was right next door. But it's just one of those things you're like, we'll go tomorrow. And then you never get to it, but we still plan on going there.
Let me put it to you this way. Every time I go to Granada, I can feel the spirit of God moving through the city.
Wow.
I can just feel it.
Wow.
I can just feel it without a shadow of a doubt. I'm like,
you don't think it's too hilly? You don't think it's, you just loved it? Because, you know, it has everything. It has the Alhambra. It has, you know, I forget what the neighborhood is.
And you know what? The Albacín.
The Albacín, exactly. So you're just like, you're in love when you think about it, huh? So Spain would still be the number one.
Well, and the second place is London.
See, for London. Me, London is number one and Spain is number one, you know, but I couldn't afford to live there. So, you know, I'll just put that aside, but I like to visit, so.
And the thing about London, the reason I love London so much is because, this is what I tell people, London is everything that New York City wants to be.
Hmm. Yeah,
London is New York City if New York City was done correctly.
But you know, there are a lot of homeless people there now too. So.
Yes, but you know,
it's so expensive. You know,
it's so that part. That part. It's just like, that's why I say it's New York.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
it's very expensive still,
and even more historic New York.
But much more historic, much cleaner, much more efficient in terms of getting around.
Yes.
The people are much more polite and warm. Yes. People dress really well in London.
Yes, they do. Yes, I think that's the reason my husband loves it so much. He's Italian, so like he notices that first. It's like
how they dress so well in London specifically, and it's just like you walk down the street in London, and you're like, am I in a magazine right now?
Exactly. Like, you definitely see it. You know, you see the difference, and it's like, you know, you're so used to like not dressing up. I mean, now it's gotten so bad in the US. You can go to, even by the time I left, you know, we go to like a play, a Broadway show or whatever, and everybody's wearing sneakers. And it's just, there's nothing to dress up for anymore. Everybody's wearing like their ratty old clothes. And it's just, there's still something elegant about London, I guess.
Correct.
So it makes it.
Correct. Then I think in both of those cities, people just really know how to enjoy life.
Yes, people drink a lot.
Also that.
Yeah, so I guess you won't care about it too much after you've had a few in you.
That's so true.
I'm gonna end this interview by practicing my Spanish with you for just a couple of minutes.
Go ahead.
If that's okay. Let's see. ¿Cómo es mi español? Hola, Steven. Estoy muy feliz por el facto tú aquí, ¿no?
I understand. Okay. Do you want me to help you through it?
Yes.
I would say, estoy contenta tenerte aquí conmigo in el podcast. I'm happy to have you here with me.
I was going to say, before, like, quiero hablar contigo sobre español. Mi español es muy mal, so lo siento.
No está mal, está bien, yo te entiendo.
Mi clase acaba de terminar dos días pasado.
Hace dos días.
Sí,
hace dos días.
Hace dos días, sí. Uh-huh. Y me gusta mucho tus videos en YouTube. Porque ayúdame.
¿Me ayudan?
Me ayuda mucho para aprender un poquito más español.
Me alegro.
Antes tenía mucho miedo para hablar, pero ahora intentado con la gente cuando salía. So that's it for now.
Very good. Muy bien.
Gracias.
Muy bien. Muy bien.
I get so flustered when I try to speak it. And it's something I talk to myself a lot when I watch TV because I'm like trying to repeat it. And I'm constantly trying to break the cycle because I see it in my head. But by the time I go to say it, it just flies. Se fue. You know, it's like, but I'm going to, you know, break through it. But the teacher keeps saying, I'm improving. But she's like, you need a lot of conversation. So she says, maybe next semester, she's going to put me in a class where it's more speaking. That she's like, you know the words, you know the things. So you need to just speak. So
maybe. I would say the same thing because you know. Like you told me like, oh, your Spanish is very, very basic, but you know a lot of non-basic words. And I can tell that you're sort of familiar with more advanced sort of grammatical structures, even though you might not be an expert in them yet. I can tell you have like sort of an awareness of where you need to go.
Yes.
Which is what people at a basic level don't really have. Uh-huh. So it's kind of like, I can tell that it's there and you kind of have it. It's just going to be a matter of you doing what I did when I was a kid and going out in Valencia, listening to people, sparking up conversations with people, ask people for directions, even when you know where you're going.
Okay. And you know, everybody's like, listen to songs. I'm gonna keep on trying. I'm gonna keep talking to my television and doing all these things. And hopefully by next time you come visit with me again on the podcast, my Spanish should be much better.
Yes, and then I can invite you on my podcast.
Tell me about that. You would make a great podcaster.
Thank you.
Tell me the plans.
So once the book is out. Yeah. I'm actually going to do a podcast, which sort of takes the premise of the book and puts it into podcast form. So like I said, it's really about that, you know, identity shift and that transformation and all that allows you to experience. Mm-hmm. So this podcast, what I want to do is I want to talk to people who have become bilingual in whatever language that is. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to talk about, try this technique, try that technique, go to this school, Duolingo. I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about what has you going through this process done to shift your identity and how has it shaped your life experience? Like what things have you experienced and gotten to do and seen because you opted to learn another language? How did it change the trajectory of your life, and your life experience, and your identity? Because that is the conversation that no one ever seems to have when it comes to
language. Now that you've told them, they didn't have it before. They're like, I stole this from me.
You know, because the stories are so, so interesting. I have a friend who is Mormon. He's part of the Mormon church. Mm-hmm. And he learned Spanish when they sent him on his first mission.
Wow.
You know where they sent him?
Where?
The Bronx. They sent him to the Bronx, New York, and now he speaks fluent Spanish.
That's great.
And now he preaches the gospel. Now he preaches the gospel in Spanish.
Salvador or something, you know.
The Bronx.
Yeah, because there's so many countries in, you know. Oh, that's fantastic.
You know, and there are all those crazy kind of just interesting stories that people would just never know.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And when you really think about it in that perspective, for me, it's those experiences. It's those experiences, those life-altering, those identity-shaping experiences that language learning is all about. It's yeah. not just so that you can pass the class or get the job or, you know, have the, you know, I am fluent in this language on my resume. It's so much more than that. You know, it's really about that human connection. Because like I said, the example of my friend, he now preaches the gospel to people like in Spanish. And, you know, so like he's able to go and help other people through him learning his language. And those are sort of the conversations I want to have. I want to really introduce people to that sort of perspective when it comes to language learning.
Awesome. That's great. I'm so looking forward to the podcast. And yes. once again, you know, with this blog post and video, there will be all your information, your YouTube channel, the book, and how they can get in touch with you or sign up for, you know, a waiting list for the book or what have you. And don't forget, everyone, when he starts his podcast, check out the YouTube. You'll just love yes. it, especially if you're trying to learn English or Spanish, actually. So so you know, you can't go wrong with his YouTube channel. It's called American Boy. So make sure to check it out. And Stephen, thanks again for being on here. It's been wonderful.
Thank you for having me.
I think it's been the longest podcast I've ever done, but it was great. I didn't want it to end. It was really good.
Yes.
So thank you yes. once again. Everybody, thank you for listening to Next Bite of Life. I hope to see you on the next episode. And don't forget to subscribe to the channel, please. No matter where you're listening, whether it's Apple iTunes or Spotify or what have you. Thanks
all of it.
Again, and we will see you